Chapter 8, Love and Will. The union of love and will. The danger of untempered will is that it lacks heart. We see, and used to see, especially in Victorian times, the operation of a cold, stern, and even cruel will. On the other hand, love without will can make an individual weak, sentimental, over-emotional, and ineffectual. One of the principal causes of today's disorders is the lack of love on the part of those who have will, and the lack of will in those who are good and loving. This points unmistakably to an urgent need for the integration, the unification of love and will. To treat the subject of love as fully as we have discussed the will would require another book, but a brief consideration of some of the most important meanings of the word is necessary if we are to understand the relationship between love and will. Types of love. The first love is for oneself. Mention of this may occasion some surprise, as love directed towards oneself is generally considered to be synonymous with egotism or narcissism. This kind of self-love does, of course, exist, but it is not the only kind. Here, as always, the great complexity and multiplicity of the human being must be taken into account. In the case of self-love, all depends on what we love in ourselves and how we love it. It is truly egotism if we love the egocentric and separative aspects in us, the craving of pleasure, possessions, and domination. But if we love what is higher and best in ourselves, what we are, essentially, if we love our potentialities for growth, development, creative ability, and communion with others, then this love, devoid of egotism, urges us to live a life of higher quality. This love is then not only not an obstacle to loving others in the same way, but rather a powerful means for doing so. As with all types of love, self-love can be helped to regulate and direct itself by the will. Love for other human beings is qualified by its object. Maternal love, and we have a footnote here, the terms maternal and paternal are here used to indicate specific types of love. In most cases, both types will come from each parent, although in different proportions. Returning to text. Maternal love may be considered the first and fundamental human relationship. In its initial form, it has an oblative quality, manifesting the mother's willing devotion to the protection and care of her infant, a devotion in which the self-denial entailed is accepted joyously. However, the growth of the child is accompanied by development of a healthy independence, which puts the purely maternal aspect of her love to a severe test. Her very devotion and sacrifice in the early days of the relationship now can turn into attachment and possessiveness. The son or daughter realizes this, even if unconsciously, and resents it. The more possessive and exacting the love of the mother, the more vigorous the rebellion of the child. Conversely, the more oblative the love, the more durable and deep is the loving relationship. Again, wise use of will can make all the difference. Paternal love presents a parallel process, although with certain differences. Here too, the father's basic love for his children has an oblative quality. But this initial eagerness to provide them with material and other help often gives place later to an urge to assert his authority and demand their obedience, or else he may identify himself with a child to the extent of trying to mould him in his own image, an image which frequently is not particularly commendable. In other cases, he may bring heavy pressure to bear upon his child to achieve what he himself has failed to accomplish, an unfair and usually unrealizable demand. The result in most instances is rebellion, when instead the child submits. He does so unwillingly, and his feeling of frustration can not only hinder his development, but may damage or even kill the previous loving relationship. Love between man and woman is another area in which much semantic confusion prevails. It is the cause of frequent, I would say incessant, misunderstanding and subsequent conflict. Some writers call love for a person of the opposite sex erotic love, but the different meanings attributed to the word erotic render it ambiguous. In common parlance, as well as in much literature on the subject, eroticism is understood in a purely sexual sense, sometimes being employed virtually as a synonym for pornography. On the other hand, some philosophers and psychologists, Harking back to the Eros myth and the meanings given to it by the Greeks, regard Eros as the attraction of one sex for the other, generated by a desire to unite and merge with the other person at all levels, particularly the emotional one. In reality, love between men and women comprises a mixture of physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual attractions in proportions that differ substantially for every relationship, and also change in the process of time. This explains the great difficulty two human beings experience in understanding one another and in harmoniously uniting and integrating, hence the suffering and conflicts that ensue. The most familiar and general aspects of this love are passionate love, sentimental love, and idealistic love. No less important, though generally given scant consideration in the choice of a partner, is the love founded on intellectual understanding and that born of spiritual communion. Let us now turn to the class of love relationships other than those between people of the opposite sex. Here we have fraternal, altruistic, and humanitarian love. While they can be aroused and intensified by a feeling of compassion for human pain, they derive fundamentally from a sense of essential identity with one's brothers in humanity. In some cases, such as Franciscan love, it embraces all living creatures. A full treatment of these love relationships is contained in P.A. Sorokin's book, The Ways and Power of Love, and in Martin Luther King's The Strength to Love. There is also an impersonal love, a love for ideas or for ideals. In this too, various components and aspects are present. Fascination with an ideal or the beauty of an idea often gives birth to a dedication and self-sacrifice of a high order. But it can also lead to a fanaticism in the idée fixe. A man may become obsessed by an idea or an ideal to the point of being blind to all else, incapable of understanding and cruel to those who do not share it or who oppose it. Then there is love so distorted that it can be called a caricature of love. That is, this idolatrous love that takes the form of blind, fanatical admiration of the idols of the day, the stars of stage and screen, champions of sport, dictators and other leaders. Finally, there is the love of God, or whatever designation may be preferred to represent the universal being or beingness, the supreme value, cosmic mind, supreme reality, both transcendent and immanent. A sense of awe, wonder, admiration and worship, accompanied by the urge to unite with that reality, is innate in man. Present in every age and every country, it has given birth to many varieties of religious and spiritual traditions and forms of worship, according to prevailing cultural and psychological conditions. It reaches its flowering in the mystics who attain the lived experience of union through love. Relationships of love and will. All these kinds of love have specific relationships with the will in its different aspects. The working out of these various relationships in the particular circumstances that each individual finds himself in is obviously one of the basic tasks of each of us. Much remains to be discovered in general and also in each individual case. Here I will make some observations only about the general nature of the most important relationships between love and will. Love and will are generally present in individuals in inverse proportion. That is to say, those in whom love is predominant tend to possess less will and are little inclined to use what they have, while those endowed with a strong will often lack love or even exhibit its contrary. But this personal imbalance between love and will can be further accentuated by the essential differences in the quality, nature, and direction of the two aspects themselves. Love, being attractive, magnetic, and outgoing, tends to link and unite. Will, on the other hand, being dynamic, tends by itself to be affirmative, separative, and domineering. It tends to establish a relationship of dependence, and clearly, these differences can lead to real opposition. Love is normally considered to be something spontaneous and independent of will, something indeed that happens in a manner that may run counter to our will. However true this may be at the beginning of an effective relationship, to cultivate human love that is satisfying and enduring and creative is truly an art. Human love is not simply a matter of feeling, an affective condition or disposition. To love well calls for all that is demanded in the practice of any art, indeed of any human activity, namely an adequate measure of discipline, patience and persistence. All of these we have seen to be qualities of the will. If, as is commonly recognised, they are indispensable in mastering an art, be it playing an instrument, for example, or singing or painting, or performing any other creative activity, whoever aspires to perfect himself in his chosen field will naturally be willing to devote to the required practice all the time and energy demanded. As yet, the necessity for the same degree of application in the sphere of love is largely ignored, or, if not denied, recognised only with reluctance. The widespread incidence of misunderstanding and conflicts between those who enter into affective relationships provides ample evidence that falling in love and merely sexual and emotional attraction are insufficient for achieving successful loving. The establishment of a successful love relationship entails the possession or acquisition of an adequate amount of physical, psychological and spiritual knowledge, paralleling and in a large measure the same as that required for good willing. Thus, good will and good love are closely related. As with good willing, the knowledge relevant to good loving concerns the structure of the human being, his various functions and the laws governing them. And general differential psychology in all its aspects, see Appendix 5, page 248. After such a preparation, the specific tasks leading to the harmonisation and unification of love and will can be undertaken effectively. There are three methods suitable for this purpose. The first consists of developing the weaker of the two, making both loving and willing equally available. The second aims at awakening and then manifesting the higher aspects of both. The third is bringing them together in operation, together in alternation, in such a way that each arouses and reinforces the other. The first task is to balance the love-will combination by increasing the proportion of the weaker function with respect to the stronger one. Emotional types in whom love predominates must see to the progressive deployment of will and its increasingly active deployment. Conversely, the volitional types, those for whom the exercise of will represents the line of least resistance, have to take particular care that the quality of love tempers and counterbalances its employment, rendering it harmless and constructive. In the case of the will, the aim of the training is the cultivation of aspects in which it may be deficient. This cultivation requires the elimination of the unwillingness to engage in active training. This unwillingness has its chief source in the basic inertia existing in all of us. But an antagonistic attitude towards the will can also be caused by the excessive reaction against its harsh and immoderate imposition in the past. The elimination of such antagonism can be accomplished, as I have previously mentioned, by recognizing and appreciating the value of and need for an appropriate use of the will. The same can be said of love. Many people fear love, fear opening themselves to another human being, a group or an ideal. Sincere and honest self-examination and self-analysis, or an analysis conducted with the help of others, are the means of discovering and unmasking, and then getting rid of, these resistances and fears. The second method, that of awakening and then manifesting the higher aspects of both love and will, raises an important point of a general nature. Many of the limitations and errors of modern scientific psychology owe their origin to a failure, one might say unwillingness, to recognise that in both love and will there exists qualitative differences of level, degree and value. Yet scientific psychology, while claiming to eliminate evaluations, has frequently, and indeed almost inevitably, formulated evaluations without being aware of it. As Maslow has said, science is based on human values and is itself a value system. The existence of different levels of being have different values, is an evident and undeniable manifestation of the great law of evolution as it progresses from simple and crude stages to more refined and highly organized ones. Applying this to the sphere of love, and disregarding here the question of the relationship between sexuality and love, It is evident that a love that is overpowering, possessive, jealous, and blind is at a lower level than one that is tender, concerned with the person of the loved one, that seeks his well-being and desires the union of the best aspects of both personalities. At still another level, we find altruistic love, with its broad humanitarian perspective, animated by compassion and the urge to mitigate the sufferings and ills that beset humanity, the love called caritas or agape. How then can the differences in evolution, level and value of the various kinds of love be ignored? The same is equally true and evident in regard to the will, which, as we have seen, can at its lowest level be hard, egotistical, bent toward power and domination, ruthless and cruel. At higher levels, on the other hand, the will is directed towards objectives and purposes devoid of egotism and egocentric content. Animated by this kind of will, an individual tends to establish close relationships with other human beings and will be ready to ally his will with that of others for constructive ends. As the basic human needs are taken care of, the pool of what Maslow has termed the higher needs gradually emerges and asserts itself, and draws us toward even greater expansions of consciousness and realization. This occurs not only in the sphere of love and will, but also in the case of functions, as desire, imagination, and mental activity. We can deliberately choose to stimulate and foster this natural process of development and growth by means of skillful applications of various techniques used in psychosynthesis, such as visualization, creative imagination, meditation, the ideal model, transmutation, and sublimation. The third method aims at a gradual fusion of love and will and their resultant synergy. It forms an essential part of psychosynthesis, the process whereby the multiplicity of tendencies, the autonomous, often conflicting elements enter into an increasingly harmonious interaction, culminating in their final fusion in the integrated human being. All this, intentionally stated in simple terms as it is, seems elementary and obvious, yet how anyone who sets himself to practice it soon realizes how difficult it is. In dealing with this subject, therefore, as with others in the course of this study, the use of expressions that are simple, easily understood, and as non-technical as possible should not induce the reader to think that I consider these matters to be simple and easy to put into operation. The gradual fusion of love and will is often characterized by terms of varying duration in which external circumstances or inner urges may occasion a temporary predominance of the normally weaker or less developed function. A simple case in point is that of a volitional type of a man falling in love. Another illustration is the manner in which a disaster, such as flood or earthquake, can arouse humanitarian feelings and a sense of human solidarity in an ordinarily self-centered and unfeeling individual. In a love type, the urge to fulfill his love arouses his will to the extent that he temporarily focuses his energies on the means leading him to reach the desired objective. The principle and technique of psychosynthesis. If the various stages, qualities, and levels of the will, the corresponding ones of love, and the complex interactions between them all are taken into account, as is indeed necessary, it will be apparent that the successful endeavour to achieve synthesis between love and will demands much skill and action. It calls for persistent vigilance, for constant awareness from moment to moment. Various current spiritual movements and approaches rightly emphasise it, and it has been widely practised in the East. But this awareness, this attitude of maintaining a conscious inner presence, does not stop with the observation of what happens within oneself and in the external world. It makes possible the active intervention and commitment on part of a self, who is not only an observer, but also a will-er, a directing agent of the play of the various functions and energies. This can be done by utilizing the principle of self-identification. See the exercise of identification in Appendix 1, page 213. From the vantage point of the self, it is not a compromise between love and will which is being attempted, but a synthesis. The two elements are absorbed into higher unity, endowed with qualities that transcend those of either. The difference between such synthesis and a mere compromise is fundamental. It is indicated for a number of different situations in the triangular diagrams on pages 102 to 103. The synthesis between the stages, qualities, and levels of love and will needs to be effected in such ways. Future research outlined in the Will Project, see Part 3, should aim at ascertaining, through experiments, how these particular synthesis can best be brought about. Active watchfulness and direction of this kind demand the application of wisdom. Like the will, wisdom is little in fashion today. Most people's idea of a sage is static, picturing someone aloof and far removed from the so-called reality in life. One of psychology's tasks should be the rehabilitation of wisdom by putting forward a truer conception of its vital, dynamic, and creative nature. This image of wisdom has been arrestingly presented by Hermann Kieseling in The Recovery of Truth. The Chinese, who know more of wisdom than any other race, designate the wise by the combination of the ideographs for wind and lightning. Wise with them is not the serene old man bereft of all illusions, but he who, like the wind, rushes headlong and irresistibly on his way, and cannot be stopped nor laid hold of at any station of his career, who purifies the air in the manner of lightning and strikes when there is a need for it. And we have several triangular diagrams here, reading from top of triangle, left through right. So the first one is serenity, underneath excitement, calm, depression. Next one, spiritual dignity, self-depreciation, inferiority complex, right valuation, arrogance, superiority complex. The next one is clear vision of reality, blind optimism, practical realism, fearful pessimism. The next one is spiritual understanding, doubt, common sense, dogmatism. The next one is transmutation and sublimation, license, temperance, and repression. And finally, spiritual energy, weakness, equilibrated personality force, violence. Paradoxical as it may sound, the self must use the wise will to synthesize the various stages of love and will. This process can be carried out because an essential attribute of wisdom is the power to play with opposites, to regulate the interaction of antipodal forces and functions, thereby establishing a dynamic equilibrium and synthesis without resorting to compromise, but rather by regulation from a higher level. This general process is described in my article, The Balancing and Synthesis of the Opposites. Here are a few examples that can serve to demonstrate the operation of the wise will in various situations and help point towards the union of love and will. The polarity between mind and heart, between reason and feeling, logos and eros, is regulated first by the recognition of their respective functions and of the legitimate field of action belonging to either of the two functions, so that neither dominates the other. This can be followed by a mutual and increasing cooperation and interpenetration between the two, finally arriving at the synthesis so well expressed by Dante in the words, intellectual light full of love. The polarity between sensitivity and receptivity, pathos, and the dynamism and affirmativeness, ethos, which in a wider sense corresponds to the psychosexual polarity, for the former role is the feminine and the latter the masculine modality, can also at first be controlled by a balanced adjustment to be superseded by creative synthesis. The fundamental polarity between human personality as a whole and the transpersonal self can also be resolved into a unity. This is the aim of a long process of transmutation, involving a protected series of conflicts, approaches, and contacts, each producing a partial or more expanded fusion. In short, a process of transpersonal psychosynthesis. It constitutes the higher effort, the central drama of man, who either consciously or unconsciously aspires to this goal, or is pushed towards it by his inability to find lasting satisfaction or a true peace until he has attained it. The phases and methods of such a fusion and synthesis have been described in a preliminary way in psychosynthesis. These various equilibrations, adjustments and integrations can be produced in different ways. In a number of cases they are preceded by intense crises and conflicts. At other times they are reached in a more harmonious way by means of a gradual decrease in the oscillations of the pendulum which switches between the two extremes. A clear understanding of this process of psychosynthesis enables one to actively cooperate with it and achieve more easily and rapidly. The essential requirement, as previously mentioned, is to avoid identifying oneself with either of the two opposite poles and to control, transmute, and direct the energies from a higher unifying centre of awareness and power.